companions. We help you discover your many layers. You feel your car, you wake up with fresh eyes. Question life, question humanity, question society, but most of all, question yourself.
Talk listeners, welcome to season 2 of the podcast. This season, we'll be focusing on business and marketing strategies to sustain impact-driven work. These episodes will be useful if you are starting your social impact business, setting up a non-profit entity, understanding corporate social responsibility to work with the private sector, or learning marketing techniques to increase outreach. The first feature of the season is Jack Sim, who became a millionaire at age 29, then retired from the business world at age 40, and dedicated his life to social impact. He founded World Toilet Organization, and let's hear more about his journey from the man himself.
My name is Jack Sim. I'm a social entrepreneur. I founded the World Toilet Organization and the base of Pyramid Hub, BOP Hub. I would describe myself as a restless person. I started life with as a school failure and went on to set up 16 profitable companies from the age 24 to 40. I made some money, and then at the age of 40, I retired from business and devoted all the last 24 years of my life on social work. And I did two things. One is to break the taboo for sanitation so that toilets, shit, poop can all become normal discussion subject. And I created the United Nations World Toilet Day, 19th of November. So this is adopted by all 193 countries of the UN General Assembly. And so now toilet is legitimate and politicians can talk about it. Whereas 20 years ago, they call it water agenda. The second thing I'm trying to do is to end global poverty. So the first problem was 2.5 billion people don't have toilets. And so when they don't have toilets, they go out for open defecation, they get no privacy, the woman get raped while peeing, and they go to the bush, to the riverside, right? And then the poop goes and pollute the river, and the people downstream drink the water and get diarrhea and get sick, and some children die. So every year about 2 million people die, and this problem was not highlighted, so I open it up. And of course, in the city, there's a ladies queuing up for toilets, and there's not enough public restroom provision, so we lobbied and changed the law in several countries so that the ladies' toilet are bigger than the gents. And dirty toilet, the toilet cleaners are not trained, and all kind of toilet problem you face in tourism toilet, train station toilets, all kind of toilets. So I solved this type of problem through effective advocacy and storytelling. For the BOP Hub, it is to end poverty for 4 billion poor people. And the only way to do that is through the marketplace. So we make people do business rather than donate money to them, because charity cannot end poverty. Charity is like giving a man a fish. And trading is like teaching them how to fish. So I want to teach them how to fish.
Actually, kind of this brings me to this point, which is also why I contacted you. You shared on LinkedIn this post, if I may quote, "We built greenhouses with glass walls that trap heat, and then we spend lots of energy to air condition it. We call them skyscrapers and buildings. We fly with biofuel that competes with food production, consume water, create vast deforestation, increase chemical fertilizer and pesticides that pollute our rivers, and we call it green fuel. We switch off the lights for 1 hour and switch it back on and call it Earth Hour, as if that changed our lifestyle when it didn't. Elon Musk promote Bitcoin to buy his electric cars when Bitcoin mining burns a ridiculous amount of energy and kills our planet. We produce an ocean of plastic bottles and then try to recycle it. We spend more money on carbon neutrality when we should simply be preventing it by not consuming it. But there is no money in prevention, so we continue to consume unsustainably and pretend we really care about the planet. We need to stop our bullshit and call out the greenwashers. Frugality is the answer to climate change. Don't buy stuffs when the current ones are still good. Drink tap water and not bottled water." And this post resonated with me so deeply on so many levels, because for the longest time, coming from socially engaged arts and advocating and trying to find solutions in which these sort of projects can be financially sustainable. And then that journey brought me to sort of the business space to explore opportunities that's out there. Yet, you know, how can you create a business that allows you to do the social impact work without having to sell any sort of materials-based consumerism? And this sort of the way that the economy works based on selling more stuff to people and compelling people to want to buy more things. And how can we fix that paradox, you know, when a lot of things out there, even if they seem eco-friendly, it's actually just a tactic for CSR and publicity. So what are your thoughts around this?
I think that the consumption growth model is flawed. So the more you consume, the more your quality of life improve. This is not true. Because if you need some basics, but we have gone beyond the basic. We have gone into a throwaway society, right? We have gone into a place where we drink a bottle of water and then the residual, which is a plastic bottle, becomes a problem, and we don't care. So long ago, when life was simpler, we used fountain pen. I'm 64, so we use fountain pen. We refill it with ink, and then we repair the pen when it's spoiled. And we have one watch that the parent passed to the children, and the children passed to the grandchildren. And the watch, when it's repaired, it's spoiled, we repair, right? So we also treasure relationship. We don't divorce. We stay together and we adjust to each other. So life was very durable long ago. Then in 1973, there was a book by Alvin Toffler called Future Shock. And he predicted that in the future, we will live in a throwaway society where all our pens will be ballpoint pens and we'll throw them away after we use. And that we will start to throw away more and more plastic stuff and packaging and all that. And eventually we will get into such a habit where we will throw away our relationship and we will have no friends. We will only have Monday to Friday friends because they are our colleagues. And then when we go home, we have no friends. And this is exactly the kind of society that we live in now. You can have 5,000 Facebook friends, but you have zero friends. And I think that to return to a good, balanced society, we have to redefine the meaning of success. We cannot continue to say, if you consume, you are successful. In fact, if you consume, it must be because you need it. But if you consume beyond what you need, you are actually an antisocial behavior. And so wealth cannot be the measurement of success because distribution has to be the measurement. And we should measure people by the impact that they create. So in the future, billionaire should be one that improves the life of a billion people. And if you have money, it really doesn't matter. If you didn't use the money in a way that benefit other people, it's no use having those money. We're not going to celebrate you. And the human being wants to be celebrated, wants to be recognized. And so we should reward them with recognition of creating impact rather than jealousy, envy, and feeling small. Once you see somebody drive a big car and squander their money or wear diamonds or whatever. I think those will have to become very lame, and we need the young people to think that way and start a new trend that if somebody put on their Facebook a new car, then you can reply him to say, if you want to show off, join the circus, you know, don't come here, right? And if you just piss off such people after a while, then showing off would become a very anti-social behavior. So before you piss people off with your wealth, now people piss you off when you flaunt your wealth? Would you think that's a good thing to do?
Yeah, definitely. But also, this requires a deep cultural shift and a way of understanding things. And between you and I'm in my mid-20s. I'm 26 this year. So, you know, I think Singapore is so unique as well, because within generations, we've had such huge developments and such a big gap. And the sort of progression that happened in that short span of history, it's huge. You know, I hear from my grandparents and my parents' kampong days, and I cannot associate with the sort of life they've had, you know, not having proper toilets and all that. Yet my generation, I grew up never having been to a kampong, most likely. You know, we just have HDBs all around, nice houses. And the way that they view life, and I don't know, I feel like in between that gap, right, from poverty to affluence, because my parents' generation, or maybe even grandparents, don't want their kids to live the sort of life where it can be harsh and that food might not be there on the table, that they work really hard to then bring the money back home. So then as Singapore developed super quickly, that sort of affluence also increased. Yet my generation has this in-between state where we have had parents who provided materially but didn't really have the time for us. And then as much as, you know, in my own life, I've chosen really completely unconventional paths. I pursued the arts and really worked on community and social impact work on the ground. And that means that I'm not having the sort of, I guess, stability and financial income streams that many of my peers have. But the sort of social narrative and norm, it's still that of having a stable job, whatever that job is, it doesn't matter, that you need to be able to earn this amount of money so that you can buy a HDB or buy a house and then be able to have a big enough house or comfortable enough to provide for family, to be able to afford kids, and then all of these things. And then it comes on top of it, being able to afford tuition and enrichment classes, and then to put your kids in that sort of competitive spiral and be at the forefront of the game and have that competitive edge. So then how do you think this sort of cultural shift can happen when so much of what we are taught is successful or not is so ingrained? And also it is also a part of government's narrative to look towards prosperity in the economic sense, because then, you know, it's taxes that's coming in, the sort of narrative of be satisfied with what you need and not have to work more to earn more. And to just be content, that's very unpopular on so many different levels, which is also a thing of power relation when it comes to politics or financial interest in the economy.
I think that, first of all, we have to understand what do we need to live a good life, right? And we need to have something to eat. We need to have a house to stay, we need to have a ability to pay the basic bills. And those things in Singapore are available to almost everybody, right? 80% over of people own their own flats, and the rest of the people actually got more money to buy private properties. So we are not hungry, and we are not actually in trouble. And then almost all of us can get a job that pay us enough to buy basic life and to have kids. And no problem. Maybe you won't buy a car or a private property, but most people, if you work hard and are decent, you always have a job. Beyond that is the main problem. Beyond that, you start to compare. Oh yeah, but mine is only a 4-room flat. But you know, the other guy has a executive apartment or condo or his car. Then you get very distracted. But if you say, nah, that's fine. I'm quite solved my problems already. Then you find higher meaning in life and you find more important things to do. The most crazy thing I've seen is somebody who sold their 1,500 square foot HDB flat to buy a 1,000 square foot condominium. That means he lost 500 square foot and he pay much more money and he call himself upgrading. And I say, upgrade or downgrade? You got less space, but you did that just kind of for your face. But who's looking at you? Nobody. The truth is, people are not looking at you. You are always showing off to yourself. When I was 13 years old, I was always combing my hair. And in those days, it's the Greece culture where everybody is combing their hair. You know, John Travolta, I don't know, nobody knows that guy anymore. So I was combing my hair and I was like, oh, my hair has to be totally neat. And I was at the canteen and was asking myself, does other people look at my hair? And the answer is no, nobody is looking at your hair. And so I asked myself, why did I say they are not looking at my hair? And the answer is, I'm not looking at their hair. I'm not interested in anybody's hair except my hair. That means that they are all the same. And that means everybody is only looking at their own hair, but trying to imagine that other people are interested in that. So I threw away my comb. I don't need to impress anyone. And I'm very comfortable with my own image. And then I focus myself not on how I look, but on doing things that are more important.
Something that I've been sort of working on and researching, it's also how financially socially engaged projects can be continued. Because to be able to work on socially engaged projects full-time, working with communities or working on things that contribute to that impact, it's so difficult to get the funding to do it. So either you're dependent on government or sort of public, private funds, donations to be able to support the work, or people would have to just do like a full-time work and then use the money from there and then do another full-time work, which is the work that they're doing with communities to sort of support the projects there. So I wonder if you have any sort of learnings or tips from your journey setting up WTO that you can share with other people who are on this journey as well, to sort of have a clear understanding or some advice on how to sort of shortcut some of the processes or I guess what are some of the learning that would be very beneficial for them to know of.
Yeah, so the World Toilet Organization reaches out to about 2.5 billion audience a year. We spend nothing on media. We don't pay a dollar for consultancy. We don't have many staff. I employ only one full-time staff and one part-time staff. And our impact of changing the narrative on sanitation agenda was really, really big, and we could influence public policy all the way up to Brazil, where last year they changed the law after our lobbying for a bill to get the private investment into their sewage treatment plant. So right now, about 13 billion investment, and potentially they can reach $100 billion of investment to their water company to treat the sewage, 50% of which is not treated before the bill is passed. So we could create a lot of impact in India with building 110 million toilets with Prime Minister Modi. And he actually came to Singapore to make this official thank you photograph with us. We are now working with President Xi Jinping, China Toilet Revolution. And we only employ one person full-time and one person part-time. So the number of people we employ versus the impact is very disproportionate. And how do we do that? Because to raise money is very difficult. So we don't have a fundraising department. We don't go around raising money. We raise volunteers and we raise people who really genuinely want to solve this problem. And so when you have volunteers, you don't pay salaries. So you save a lot of money. Then for, let's say our building, we have a new building, we have new furniture, all the furniture is donated by Microsoft. So we have not just furniture, but we have Herman Miller furniture. We have furniture that is most expensive, which we could never imagine. And then we have all the carpet, the interface carpet tiles, and they are all donated by Microsoft because when they shift the building, they give us everything. And you know, carpet, the carpet that is under the table are always brand new. So we took all this good carpet and we lay it on our floors. And how do you lay it? 100 Microsoft volunteers came to lay the carpet and to fix the furniture. And the transportation is also paid by them. So we are always rallying for people to donate their time, donate their product. Then by this process, you almost spend very, very little money. And one advice I want to tell young people is if you want to start something, don't start thinking about money. Don't start thinking about spending money. Therefore, you don't need money. And so whatever you need to use the money to spend on could be products, could be employees, then get volunteers and get donation kind.
Jack, you mentioned in a talk, when you are a visionary, you paint the picture of the future today. Could you kind of sort of explain your journey and how you managed to do that? Because when you're trying to bring a value into something that I guess maybe society hasn't quite seen the value of it yet or seen the need for it, how do you still charge forward and be able to build that vision in other people's minds?
So you have to paint a narrative of a destination that is more beautiful than today. And invite everybody to this new destination and explain to them that we want to go there, but we don't know how to go. So I also don't know. And let's find out together. And you have to let them take ownership of the planning process, the imagination, the journey, and they will love it. If you are the leader and all the time you are saying you are the leader and you are the one deciding, you will soon find out that they don't want to follow you. But if you make them the leader and let them take decisions and you are their follower, you are their facilitator, you are their servant, then I think you will find that a lot of people will join you because it's let's go there together, not you go there, you know? You don't give instruction to people. You invite them to join you. And then if they find that they are the right fit, they join you. Some people will say, I want to join. I'm so excited. And then they will, suddenly when you give them work, they'll say, I'm so busy, right? So those people are what you call, they live by scarcity. They always think things cannot be done and they're scared. So those type of people, don't bother with them. A lot of them are like that. So don't bother with them. Just bother with that few guys who are really interested. And only a few people is better than a lot. If you have a lot of people who is just creating bureaucracy and waste your time organizing them, then you will not have time to do the real work. But if you find quality people that really are mission-driven, it's very fun to work with them. And there's not many around. The bullshit people are most of the supply are the blah blah people, talk a lot, never do work, most of them. You will find that after a while you will have sometimes nobody and just yourself doing the work. But don't worry, you do the work and you start looking for new people again. Through trial and error, you will find good people. And then the one lazy one, they'll just disappear by themselves. You give them a lot of work, they'll disappear.
Would you say that one key thing is also to keep the good energy around you, to keep the good people with you, and whoever that doesn't align with you to sort of draw the line and stay away?
No, they shouldn't be aligned or not aligned with you. They should be aligned with the mission. That means it's not about you. Because a lot of people want to be a hero. And then it's about you. It's wrong. It has to be about the mission, which means the good thing that we, the journey, the destination that we want to go to. And we are all going there together. And so the leader is the destination, not the person, you know. And then you will not have all this fight and conflict like I'm the greatest, I'm the tallest or whatever. Don't do that. When you do that, you will lose members because then the politics happen. Always your idea, none of my idea. Okay, you're so smart, you do it yourself, I'm gone, right? So you need to give agency to everyone. However, the ones that are really not competent and talking rubbish, it's better they go. So you have to decide who is good, who is not. But every day you have to ask yourself, am I deciding based on the mission rather than my own whims and fancy, right? So once you are able to clear your own internal system that you want to do good rather than want to be famous, I think it will be very healthy and other people will be the same.
There's this thing that I struggle with, which is that the non-profit world and the for-profit world functions very differently. In the for-profit world, I sort of came to realize that it's very transactional. So then going in from a non-profit perspective, it feels like a lot of times I find myself in positions where I'm exploited and they would try to negotiate for offering a service for free or at a much discounted price because they know that I'm doing stuff that is for community or to open up social conversations. I wonder if you have sort of tips in negotiating that.
No, it depends on many, many things. First of all, you need to feed yourself. So you need those customers who pay. And then you can feed yourself already. Then you can help the one who can't pay. But the one who can pay, you charge them. The one who can't pay, if you like them, you help them. If you don't like them, you don't help them, right? So it's all very easy to decide because if you can pay and you still want it for free, I don't feel like I want to help you. So just don't. So you won't be exploited because you are the one who choose, right? And transactional. It's always transactional, no matter what happens, whether private or public sector or social sector, it's always transactional. For example, somebody want to make a film of my life story, right? And then he says, the first round, I will pay you $5 for the exclusivity of your entire life story. And that is not money, that is just contractual so that there is a money paid so that I am tied up for the contract. So the second one will be if I get funded, then I'll pay you a certain amount of money from the budget of the production because now I got money, I'll pay you something. And then thirdly is that the film, when it goes out, it will tell the story of Motala organization. So how do I decide? If I decide that, oh, I don't get money, I don't want. I don't decide that. I decide that, what is my mission? My mission is to inspire people and is to teach them that this is possible and you can do something with no money and you can leverage everything. And this is by itself also a leverage. So when the film go out, then the impact of the film can be very, very good. So I'm going to say yes. Will he benefit? Well, he will benefit if the film was a success. If he made a very lousy quality one, it will fail. I can't control the quality. I hope it was best and the story is good enough for people to want it. And then I will do my best to help him make it a success. So in reality, there's no hard and fast rule. You decide what is your priority. But in my case, I do not need the money. So I'm going to say it's all right. See, now go to another situation. The other day, I have a billiard table in my house. It's so big, right? It requires a very big room. It's like 8 feet by 16 feet. Yeah. So it's a very, very big billiard table. So I say, anybody wants it, I'll give it to you. And a guy says, I got a very big house. I want this billiard table, but I want it for free. And then another guy say, I'm a furniture showroom. I want to buy it. I'll pay you $2,000. Of course, I take the $2,000 because both of them are commercial. The other guy is very rich. So I take the $2,000, right? But if an NGO wants it, then I want to know why this NGO wants it. And if he wants it, I'll give him for free. So there's three types of situation, right?
What were some of your biggest challenges in the work that you do with WTO? And what were some of the key moments that built World Toilet Organization?
Of course, the most highest peak was that I created the UN World Toilet Day. And when you see the UN General Assembly unanimously approve it, and all 193 governments approve it, I think that's like, wow, if tomorrow I die, that's all right. You know, I've done something, right? And then along the way, when we see Prime Minister Modi building 110 million toilets, President Xi Jinping become toilet champion, you kind of get very happy because the influence can legitimize top leaders in the world to do such things. So those are very, very key moments that is even growing all the time. When I was asked to lobby to the Brazilian senators, and I don't even speak Portuguese, right? They fly me to Brazil to lobby, to convince the Brazilian senators to table such a bill to allow private investment in their sewage treatment plant. I think those are very, very powerful moments where you say, yes, just everything works. And then there are all the other moments, which is much more than all these successful moments where everything doesn't work, right? So I go to Andhra Pradesh, they appoint me as a co-convener of this India state called Andhra Pradesh. And I'm supposed to oversee their bureaucrats building toilets, but they don't want to give me the numbers. They're probably hiding their incompetence. They don't like people to check. So in the end, I go there and I waste my time because although I have the title, I don't have the power to fire them, right? So they try to give me all kind of excuses and all that. So I waste my time. So very often bureaucrats are difficult. And politicians are easy, but if the bureaucrats don't follow through, the politicians actually are ineffective. So I would say most of the time trying to talk to government can be very, very difficult. But once a while, when it is successful, it's all worth it. You know, all the other failure doesn't matter anymore. But you have to know that there is an average. There's a betting average. Let's say you get one time success every 12 times you try. So you will try to say, I want to succeed one time every 10 times. So I'm improved already by 20%. And then next time, every time I try, every 5 times I try, I got one success. Wow, then that's already very good. But there's no such thing as everything you try successful. That's not possible. So you might first start with every 100 times you try, you got one success. maybe in the beginning it's like that. Yeah.
So much of impact work, I realized it's also about social capital and connections, be it in the private sector or the public sector or the people sector, they are all really important. And I remember that in one of the talks you mentioned that mutual exploitation is collaboration, which I thought was very poignant, because a lot of times it's gray and it's blur, even if, say, I don't agree with a certain company's business model or agenda, but if it can serve the interest of the mission that I'm working towards, do I or do I not take it on? You know, these sort of questions. And I wonder, what is your take on that? Do you just take on whatever would further the mission that you're working towards, or are there sort of other considerations holding you back?
Mostly, if it helps the mission, I will do it. So if you work with politicians, most likely you're working with a corruptor, but you don't care. As long as they build toilet, you should go ahead, right? If you work with a religious leader, they might be divisive people. You say, this is my group and that is their group, but it doesn't matter. As long as they want to build pilot, you are their friend. You are always on the part that the good part of them. And if you ask me whether an alcohol company, if they sponsor me, I'll take the money. I'll take the money. If a casino sponsor me, I will take the money. Because my mission is to go and solve a problem. Why would I not want to solve the problem when I'm given a chance? It's not about me. It's about the mission. So I think that the answer is yes, I will do whatever works for the mission. But if you want me to do something like endorsing a product and say, everybody go and buy this skincare product or whatever, I can't do that, because then I will be biased. So my neutrality is important. I'm not going to be promoting sales speech for products. So every time when the company come and sponsor me, I say, yes, you're sponsoring the World Toilet Organization, but I'm not endorsing, right? I'm not endorsing the product. I'm receiving your sponsorship. So that kind of conversation is very important.
But if they are sponsoring, I mean, they would do that so that they could use it for publicity on their end. So then how do you remain neutrality when your logo or what you stand for, your image, it's going to be used on their sort of social media all over?
Well, in a sponsorship, it is they endorsing our activity. So that's fine. The fact that we allow their brand to give us sponsorship means that we accepted that they are legitimate, right? However, it is different. We didn't say buy this product. You know, we are almost saying this company support us and they are kind and we appreciate. That's what we are saying. But we do not say, do you know that this product is actually better than the competitor? Never.
So it's just appreciation and then giving the credits received with thanks. Thank you very much.
Yeah, for them, they get a brand transfer. They get a feeling of being associated for a good cause. That's a very good transaction. But they also know that if I endorse their product, then they have no use for me, because they are coming to me for the neutrality.
Mm.
So they appreciate that I'm neutral.
So speaking on branding, you do like guerrilla marketing strategies and just really interesting marketing techniques. Very creative, very fun, very artistic, very humorous. Could you sort of talk through the process of that?
Yeah, guerrilla marketing requires no money. It's sensational. It makes people shock, right? So if you look at Richard Branson, he has no money when he begins. So he created this guerrilla marketing. He do he wear a bridal gown. I mean, he has a beard, right? So he wear a bridal gown and run along the beach and create this virgin bride. And it's sensational, right? Even later on, the bridal gown company actually go bankrupt, but people remember Virgin. And then he goes on to do Virgin Train and Virgin Airline and Virgin Records at first and all that. So all his branding, he doesn't spend any money. Even the brand Virgin is actually a sex subject. So people like sex. So he says Virgin and then they're very happy, right? So I think he is the guru in guerrilla marketing. And so those people are in my modus operandi. There's also another guy called Mr. Condom in Thailand, and he promotes condom by calling it that condom is a girl's best friend. So you don't get to get pregnant, you don't get diseases, you know. So he went around blowing balloons in massage parlor and explained to the prostitutes that you have to wear a condom, otherwise you cannot keep on working, you might get sick and lose your income, and what about your family and all this thing, right? So he's using guerrilla marketing for the social sector, and it did very well, and he probably saved millions and millions of people's life by making a joke out of himself, right? And then I asked him, what are the key lessons? And he said to me, if you can make people laugh, they'll listen to you. If they laugh at you, you cannot be upset. If they laugh at you, it's because they're listening to you. So you should be happy, right? And so these two theories I follow, and then I make a clown out of myself. And then finally is that I'm not important. The message is important and the end impact is important. So if I look like a piece of shit, that's fine, because that will help people address the problem. So a lot of people are very self-conscious because they kind of want to impress others, but you know, I threw away my comb, so I'm not very bothered about how I look. I'm more interested about whether the thing works. And I think that is an important lesson to learn.
Yeah, I have to ask this question. Are you someone who is naturally shy in front of the camera, or you are completely comfortable having that personality that is fun, that is exciting, that is outgoing?
I'm not shy. I was very shy. And then in primary school, my teacher always sent me to the principal for public caning on stage, because I was very talkative in class, always disturbing the teacher, talking behind and laughing with my friends. So she always sent me for public caning. And because I go on stage so often, I have no more stage fright, right? And the public caning was a form of training. And in fact, I go there, I pretend that it hurts, you know? I just trying to give some value to the principal so that he can kind of use me to educate the rest of the school. But I was very concerned about that he's getting value. And you see, it's a completely different mindset. Like, oh, I'm being hurt. Oh, he shamed me. Oh, he makes me look bad in front of my friends. And then when I come back, I just rub my friend and I continue giggling with my friends and nothing. Nobody, if you don't feel ashamed, nobody is going to say you should feel ashamed, but I don't. So I think those are very important. I think that if we love what we're doing, if we're living in love, then the fear part doesn't disturb us. You know, the fear part will make us feel nervous, feel envious, feel wondering what people think of us, and waste a lot of time, because fear gives us a lot of distraction. But if you are on the love side, it's like, what's the mission? What can we do? What is meaningful? How can I be more useful? And those questions makes you so busy that you have no time to quarrel with people, no time to have self-doubt and no time to imagine what other people think of you, because those are time wasters.
What were some of the processes of creating those marketing campaigns? Because they are all super creative. Like there is one where you are literally in a toilet bowl costume and your body pops out of that toilet bowl. And then sometimes you wear the shape of the poop. And there are all these super creative ways of interventions that also gives the media a big laugh. And there's so much incentive for them to want to share that. How did you get inspired for all these different creative techniques?
I must say that most of the ideas came from toilet while I'm inside peeing or pooing or showering. Showering is actually a very nice time to get good ideas. And because the water therapy is very nice. And I think that every time you have an idea, write it down and try to think about how to make it better. And if you keep on thinking and searching and imagining and wanting it, then every once in a while, a very good idea will pop up. So I've got like this one. This is a James Bond 007 turn upside down, become Lou, right? So I make a James Bond film like Royal Flush or something like that. And of course, when we created the World Toilet Organization, we have the acronym WTO, and was hoping that the World Trade Organization would sue me so that the subject will be famous. And then they didn't sue me, so I continue using it and playing the pun on World Trade Organization. And this kind of guerrilla marketing costs nothing. And the media love it, and then they keep on writing about it. So every time I'm still thinking, what's the next image, the next story? And a lot of that is inside philosophy, right? If you think about philosophy and you think about things on the flip side, a lot of ideas comes.
When you first started, how did the stories or photo shoots get to media?
I was also very shocked, because when I started it, I call it the World Toilet Summit, and it was 19th of November, which later on became the UN Day, at the Singapore Expo. And so I don't have money to do this big World Toilet Summit. So what I did was I tell Edward Liu, my friend who is hosting the building exhibition, I say, you are doing the exhibition. Can I help you sell some exhibition booth? But you don't pay me commission. In return, you will give me a World Toilet Summit, because you have already the space, the staff, everything is there. It doesn't cost you very much to extend another 2 days of that conference room, which is empty, and then give me a World Toilet Summit. So he says, okay, if you sell 16 booths, I will give it for free. Then we got I sold 16 booths for him. He got it for free, and then he also helped me with press conferences and all that. Everything was for free. And I invited 15 countries, government and NGOs, and they arrived. And I was shocked that the world media loved this story so much that Associated Press, Reuters, Wired magazine, everybody was just reselling the stories high speed overnight, you know. And BBC and India Press and Asahi Shimbun in Japan and Russia, overnight, it was a shock that the next morning, I was checking the internet like everywhere. In those days, social media was just starting, 2001, not much social media, mostly was traditional media. And it's easily like a few hundred million people read about it. And so every year we say, okay, today is World Toilet Day, we declare it. Then every year we just say 10 things to do on World Toilet Day. And then people start to follow and pick it up. And throughout the year, we keep on making it very funny. The very interesting thing is that when they have heard about World Toilet Organization or Mr. Toilet, they never forget. For the rest of their life, they never forget because it's bizarre. So right now, what I plan to do is to make an avatar of Mr. Toilet into all the children book so that we can go into every primary school in the world where hygiene is taught in the schools. So I want to start with Singapore schools. We're still looking for government to agree. And then once they agree, I think it's easy to get a sponsor to kind of produce the book. And then we can give the license to the government for free, like Ministry of Education. Then they can produce it and they print the book themselves. Then after that, digitize it and turn it into 100 languages. So I think these are scalable ideas that cost nothing. Of course, it'll cost something, but I didn't pay it. Don't have to pay for it.
How does your week look like at WTO? Like what? How much time do you spend on marketing? How much time do you spend on strategizing? What kind of work are you doing? And because you don't necessarily need to do the fundraising since you've built up enough base to be able to get the sponsorship. So then what are the things that you focus on that allows you to achieve the impact?
So I don't really have a typical week. I don't have a typical day. So like today, I'm talking to you on podcast because I have time. Tomorrow, I have a fireside with a maker space. And prior to this, just before you, I've been talking to National Archive. They are recording a record of my life story. So we have done 16 hours already inside archive. And then now, 8 years later, we are doing a review of what happened again since 2012. So 8 years ago, we stopped. And then earlier in the morning, I was talking to a volunteer about the 20th anniversary book of the World Toilet Organization, which records the body of work that we do. So these are volunteers writers that writes very well, and they are doing it. Yesterday, I was preparing all my startups for a demo day for 29 next week. And we are inviting all the funders and investors to come and listen to our startup. So about 5 of them are ready for funding. Then there's another 4 of them not ready. So the not ready one is asking for help. So people may not give money, but they might give help. And then I am on a course, last 2 weeks studying Harvard, system change leadership. And now I'm on another course, which is 3 years, studying how to scale up my impact. And we're making another film called The Red Sari in India. I've written the script, they have authored it, and then now we all funded the script. And that is a Bollywood movie. So right now I'm also this weekend, I have to be a children book illustrator. It's the first time I've ever done that. So I've taken up this assignment to write 24 pages of, to draw 24 pages of children book. So it's very interesting, right? All the time it's like that.
It's so interesting how you end up getting so many different opportunities and that you are still constantly learning and improving and challenging yourself and doing new things. What was the sort of process that sort of helped you build it up to this point? So I'm just thinking of everyone else who are maybe, you know, sort of green in the social impact space and are trying to build up that impact or trying to build up their presence, or trying to fine tune what is it that they want to focus on and how they will be able to do it. And sort of recalling and hoping to be able to trace back your steps, what were the sort of key points in your early days that would be beneficial for people who are starting up to know?
The key point is having fun, being naughty, breaking rules, being curious, always wondering, are you sure this is right? challenging status quo, you know. And when you fail, don't give an image of yourself like you are a failure. Just kind of like, okay, I'm not good in this. Let me go and do something else, you know. Like school, I really not good at school. So I fail everything in school. But I'm a good salesman because I was always talking at the back of the class. So that talent was not tested, right? Salesmanship was not part of the 7 subject that I took exam for. So it's number 8 subject. I was very good, but they didn't give me marks for it. Right? And then later on, I do business and I found doing business is so much easier than studying. And then I went back to university and graduated when I was 56 and get a master's degree. And right now I'm a professor at the NUS. And when I was 59, I went to Singularity University to study technology. And now I'm at least able to discuss all kinds of technology with people. I studied 3 months in Silicon Valley, right? Of course, sponsorship. The Harvard course last week was also sponsorship, right? So I always study for free. And so the curiosity is not like, oh, after I learn, I got my degree and then finish. I'm continuously curious. And so to be curious, you have to do things that you've never done before, right? I still hope to be a drummer. I want to join a band, but I don't know if you know somebody who is a good personal drum teacher, please send them to me. I'll learn how to play drums. I always see drummers as like really fun, you know, but I got teacher that told me not to come back anymore because I signed up for drumming classes and he says, I need you every week at the same day of the week. You cannot just keep on changing appointment. I don't want you. So I stopped my drumming lessons. But I want to keep on doing things. Mm.
Wow, there's so much curiosity and appetite for life and learning.
Yeah.
I think there were these moments in my life when understanding how broken the system can be and understanding the climate crisis and the severity of it, I fall into despair. And I mean, you're speaking when in your 60s, I'm speaking in my 20s, and I feel like you've got much more zest and love for life than I do at 26. And I find that infectious, you know, having that sort of perspective and realizing that getting to my mid-20s, that's actually still quite a short time. Yet all that you've achieved and continued learning, there's so much in there that can be exciting about life, regardless of how pessimistic the future can look.
No, the future is whatever it is, and then we can do whatever we can do. So, for example, climate change. I am so bored watching all this iceberg melting and snow, glacier disappearing. It doesn't mean a thing because it does not touch people in the place that they can take an action, right? So that is what I call moralizing. Moralizing doesn't lead you anywhere. If you say toilets are dirty because people don't behave themselves, and then what is the solution? No solution. So if you say climate change is so important, but let's continue to build glass building because, you know, it's easier to clean and it looks so posh and people will buy my property when the window is bigger and HDB flat have smaller windows. They are more climate friendly, but people don't like to buy. Just tell the people, this is more climate friendly, and then do the narrative rather than give them full height glass window. You see, the smaller the window, the less air conditioning you need, right? And then if you design with more ventilation, you actually can solve climate change. So in reality, Earth hour is kind of like a bullshit. Switch it off and then switch it on again. And then every year I see that 2 photographs, the building go dark and then come on. What's different? Nobody changed any behavior. And I asked the founder of Earth Hour. I said, what's your impact? And he says, honestly, I don't even know what's the impact. Right? They don't know. So that's the situation. Then you try to do the things that can make a difference, and whatever cannot, you just wait for the disaster to happen, and then you will be sure that they will very, very quickly solve the problem. So try to bring the future forward so that people can see what is actually going to happen, and it will accelerate it. But trying to moralize it by showing the iceberg melting or the polar bear standing on a small piece of ice, I think those doesn't change anything.
So would you say it's more effective to imagine the future and vision it as clearly as possible and then selling that to the rest of the world and painting it as clearly as people can imagine?
It's better to tell people, here are the action, do this, and it will improve by a little bit. But if everybody do this, it will improve a little bit more. And then there's another 1,000 other items. And also, please go and think of new items to do, but create an action-orientated route rather than moralizing. Because a lot of this advertisement that we see, even when you look at their pledge, just this Joe Biden pledge, I'm going to do this by 2060. I mean, he's dead, right? 2060. You think it's actually true? So the main question I ask is, are all these pledges legal binding? That means if they don't do after they promises all these things, what happened? And the answer is, nothing happened. It's just talk. And whether they do or don't do. So you can get the Brazilian Bolsonaro saying, I'm going to do this, and you know he won't do. So a lot of these are fluff. So you have to be able to read a political message if this is going to be actually happening or not. So fortunately in Singapore, most of the time, if they say something, they do it. But it's not the same in America. In fact, 4 years later, it could be Donald Trump come back again, right? So nothing is very, very real. So only you can do things that you can do, and the rest of the other people. Don't be too over scared about things. Just pragmatically say, all right, if I make a campaign, don't buy stuff. Then I make a campaign, don't buy stuff. I can measure, maybe people didn't buy. So people tell the campaign, right? This year, I never buy any new clothing because all the clothing fits last year. So you make a challenge, right? A don't buy stuff challenge, right? 1 month, 6 months, 1 year. And 1 year is very difficult. Maybe you have to buy underwears, but maybe you don't need to buy shirts, right? So you kind of make a game, and then people play the game, and by playing this game, they promise themselves, and then they save money, and they say, I didn't buy stuff, and actually I saved $2,000. So I put that money in the bank, you know? And so make a game like that. I think that will be better.
I ask this question to everyone who comes on the podcast. If there's one thing that someone can do to create change in this world, what would it be?
Is to find something that you really believe needs to go away. Something that makes you very angry that is still there. And then think deeply how to make that thing go away. For example, you might be a victim of family violence, and then you don't want family violence to happen at all, and then you think how, right? Or you saw somebody beating up their wife or something like that, and then that makes you very angry. Then you start to think how to solve that problem. Or you saw another type of issue. I don't know what it is. It just upsets you and you want to solve that. For example, a few days ago, I was very upset that the construction worker just flew off their pickup truck because there was an accident. But we knew that the government did not secure these people with seatbelt when they asked us to secure ourselves with seatbelt. And they will fine us if we didn't secure ourselves with seatbelt, but they don't mind the construction worker having no security at all. And these are accidents waiting to happen. So it makes me very angry, right? And I would really love to do something to solve this type of problem. And I would love that whoever is listening to this podcast who wants to solve problem and don't know how to, just contact me and let's figure it out and let's start teams, you know, start a lot of teams to do this problem, this problem, this problem, like that. But whoever comes, please don't run away, right? If you plan to run away, don't come.
So, Jack, like, I make films and I make art and, you know, for problems like violence against gender or domestic violence or racism, for me, the sort of go-to place is that telling stories, but then opening up spaces for conversations, because these are so many things that is cultural norms, expectations, social relationships, dynamics that require a certain level of personal transformation, which without conversations to tackle these preconceived notions or ideas, it's very difficult to get a person to change because the person has to want to change himself or herself. But then I find it really sort of difficult in the social impact space when funding and grants are mostly looking at only sort of the more tangible impact in terms of what I can measure, what I can implement, install, and then that's the impact work that we're going to fund. And it almost feels like that in-between stage where all the conversations are happening through artistic process on various different methods, it almost feels like it's seen as less important or less impactful. What do you think of this?
No, I think don't care about the authority, don't care about other people. You can't control them. Don't care about the funder, don't care about resources. Just create things yourself. If you have to depend on other people, it's not going to help, right? You have to keep on thinking what you can do. But if you say, I can do only when there's funding, then there's a lot of things you cannot do. So don't think like that. Just think like, imagine that some years later, I think you're not a mother yet, right? But some years later, you have a baby. And then when you give birth to a baby, you say, first of all, do I get funding? If I don't get guaranteed funding for the next 25 years, I'm not going to have this baby, because what happens? You'll run out of money in 5 years' time. I'm going to give it away to my neighbors, you know, because this project is like no more, right? This project ran out of funding, so the baby is no more my child. Do you say that? You don't say that, right? Once it's your child, right? So if you create a project, it's your baby. And so if you have to treat everything that you do like it's your child, you don't give up, but you do not have a budget. And you know, MBA women, they do not write a business plan to a child to say, this child will give me revenue model after 25 years, you give me like $500 a month and then 2,000 and then 7,000 and then I'll make a profit 25 years later or 100 years later. They don't do that. They're just like, I love this project and I'm going to make it. And if you take every project as if you are the mother of the project, every project is lovingly done. But if you take the project as if like, oh, this is a burden, you know, this is so much problem, nobody thank me, shit, then don't do. Because the mother never say, nobody thank me. The mother say, this is my baby. And if you want to do something, do it like a mother.
Oh, thank you. I end off the podcast asking everyone, what is your favorite dish with onions?
I like onions. I think fried onions, deep fried onions. Onions goes with most food, most seafood. onion eggs probably is the easiest one.
Thank you, Jack.
Onion eggs will be good.
Is that for dinner?
Last night I have it.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Peel the layers and be the change. Onion's Talk podcast keeps you going when times are tough, and I crystallized learning that you can apply on your impact work to save you unnecessary struggles. Change-making work is tough. Sometimes it feels like all the odds are against you, and it's a constant upward battle. My name is Fia, and I'm here to support you. If you're not yet on this journey, give Onion's Talk a listen. Be inspired, be touched, be motivated. I also run purpose discovery workshops online. Follow me on LinkedIn or Instagram at FEEYEH_NEO for updates, workshops, and future events. I also run a network called INSEP, International Network for Socially Engaged Practitioners, and we are always looking for partners and funders to continue cross-sector conversations and facilitate collaborations towards systems change. Check out my website at fieneo.art and get in touch if you'd like to work together. If you like this episode and would love to support, subscribe, leave a rating, write a review on iTunes, and consider donating. Your gift will allow me to continue supporting changemakers in a more sustainable way. Onion's Talk is on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, and most other podcasting sites. If it's not there, send me an email at heyonionstalk@gmail.com. Special thanks to Andrea for the music. Catch you next episode.